Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today on the program, Marjorie McKinnon is here to talk about her new book, Repair Your Life, a program for recovery from incest and childhood sexual abuse. It is out now on Loving Healing Press. So a little bit about Marjorie. In 1988, Marjorie entered a program for recovery from incest, a journey that would take her almost 5 years to complete. During that time, she wrote about her experience, a chronicle of going from a place of despair to one of joy. That book, titled Let Me Hurt You and Don't Cry Out, was her first attempt to publish. Marjorie spent the next 3 years developing a program of recovery from child sexual abuse. She titled her self-published book, Repair Your Life, and used it as an accompaniment to seminars she taught in the Los Angeles area. This book has recently been released by Loving Healing Press, with the children's version soon to follow. In the last 10 years, Marjorie has completed 5 novels and 5 other nonfiction works. She is currently doing speaking engagements around the country and is the founder of The Lamplighters, a rapidly growing movement for survivors of incest and child sexual abuse. Currently, there are 34 Lamplighter chapters in 23 states, a chapter in Tokyo, Japan, one in England, and one in Ontario, Canada. And The Lamplighters website, just for your info, is thelamplighters.org. So I am very happy to have Marjorie on the phone. Thank you for joining us today, Marjorie.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great. You know, it sounds like this Lamplighters movement is really expanding in a very short amount of time. So I would like to hear kind of how you started it and where it's at right now.
Oh, okay. Well, originally I wanted to use it as an adjunct for people who are working the repair program. I felt that they would want to be with a group of other women who are working it as well, or people, just men too have this problem. And that's what it was going to be in the beginning. And I started a chapter here in northern Arizona, where I live, Cottonwood, Arizona. And then somebody said, you know, you need to go national with this. And so I did what I thought I would never do. I got on MySpace and made myself a profile on MySpace. And I started meeting other people and found that there were an awful lot of women on MySpace who had this problem of child sexual abuse as a background problem. And so I began asking people if they wanted to start Lamplighter chapters for me in that area, in their area where they lived. And the response was enormous. And then I got on Facebook and did the same thing. And now then I started getting responses from all over the world. So, yes, in a very short period of time, it just really increased. One of the most interesting things is that my first chapter outside of where I am now was a little town in northern Minnesota called International Falls, Minnesota, right on the border, a Canadian border.
Mm-hmm.
And they contacted me and wanted me to come back and do a series of speaking engagements in their area and to talk to their chapter, which they had started. And the unusual part about that is that happens to be the town where I was born.
Oh, you've got to be kidding.
No, and they did not know that. So it was just, when I was going through recovery, one of the things I did was I went to my father's grave. And I spent several hours there crying and angry and everything, getting everything out that had been building up for all those years. And at the end I told him, if you want to make amends for what you have done, you will help me get the word out by some kind of a program or a movement, by my writing in some way to help other people around the world. If you want to make amends, you will do this. And so when I found out that International Falls, which by my father had delivered me in the middle of a blizzard, they couldn't get out the front door because it was covered with snow.
Wow.
I just thought that was an amazing sign. And so today, yes, we have a chapter in Japan, and the woman in Japan is going to translate the book Repair and is now looking for a publisher over in Japan for that. She does amazing, amazing work in her area with this problem. And, you know, some of the chapters, you know, after a while they can't do it, and then a new one picks up, and so the number of chapters fluctuates.
Mm-hmm.
they're all having probably the same problem I have here, and that's trying to get people to come. But otherwise,
is it weekly meetings, or what does it entail, Marjorie?
Oh, I let anybody who wants to be a lamplighter, they make their own decisions on that. This is you decide how often you want it. Like, we have ours once a month. Some chapters have it once a week. You know, some start out with once a month and find that they need to increase it because the women need more help than once a month. And they decide where they're going to have it, how long it's going to be. And basically they get it all set up, and then they start putting out flyers and getting the word out. And that's how they start the chapter.
And that's how it's formed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. And so your book, Repair Your Life, that's used as a workbook for this program or a reference book? Or how is this book tied in?
Some of the chapters, like the International Fall chapter, are using the book. They buy the book, and they're using it as a model for recovery and working it at their particular lamplighter chapters. I have other people that are working the chapter on their own but don't want to be a part of a chapter. I mean, they don't want to, you know, it's very hard to get people to come out of hiding.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people just have a chapter but are not working the program at all. It is not necessary to be working the repair program to start a lamplighter chapter or be a lamplighter. But I recommend it very strongly because I think it's an excellent model to going through wellness and would be wonderful in a program, in a chapter with women.
Yes. Now, you, Lamplighter also deals with domestic violence. So tell us how domestic violence ties in with childhood sexual abuse.
Well, when you've been sexually abused or abused in any manner as a child, I mean, you, as a general rule, grow into an adult that has very low self-esteem, that has a lot of victim potential, that has a lot of codependency qualities. You know, you think that somebody else has got the answers and you don't have the right to speak up. You don't have the normal, healthy, strong, you know, parts to you that you would have if you had grown up in a healthy environment as a child. And so you're just ripe for the abuser to come along, and they pair up with abusers. I mean, people have been sexually abused as children wind up with sexual offenders. When I was, for my third offender that I was married to, my third abuser, I found out after we were married that he had sexually abused his sister for 10 years and then his daughter for many years.
Oh, boy.
And so here I was pairing off with a sex offender and thinking I can fix this, I can make this well. I mean, most of the domestic violence survivors that I have met were sexually abused as children.
Isn't that something? What a connection.
The potential is way too strong there.
Yeah. So I understand why you would include that. So now, once you went through your recovery and you were on your way to a healthy life, why did you decide to stay in this whole realm of abuse recovery?
Oh, you mean after I finished my program? Why did I decide to
Yes.
Okay, well, when I was halfway through recovery, I found out that my two older daughters had been sexually abused by my ex-husband, by my second husband. Mm. And my youngest daughter, I have three daughters and one son, my youngest daughter had been raped at gunpoint while working at a fast food place when she was 17.
Wow.
So we had three, actually counting me, we had four out of five members in my immediate family there that had been sexually abused. And then by that time I had grandchildren, and I started getting really scared. You know, what about children? What about the children? If I can somehow get a hold of the mothers, then I can save the children. And about that time, my daughter, my oldest daughter, who is a two-time Emmy Award winner, she's a sound editor for Warner Brothers, and the night after she won her first Emmy, she admitted herself to Sierra Tucson, which is a disorder clinic.
Uh-huh.
And for 30 days, and when she called and told me, I was in shock. Why? Why would you do that? And she said, Mom, I'm an alcoholic.
Wow.
And I'm also bulimic. I did not know this. I mean, she kept it so well hidden from me. And so she went there for 30 days. I went down and spent a week with her as part of their family program. And while I was there, I drew the blueprint for this program. I thought, I've got to get a program out to help people. I can't let this have happened to me and have nothing good come out of it.
Mm.
I mean, I have to do something with it. So I wrote that whole program for her and showed it to her while we were waiting for one of the classes we were going to, and I said, what do you think, honey? And she read this whole thing, which I had on this two sides of this big poster, and she said, my God, Mom, do you realize you've just written down what it's cost Warner Brothers, I think it was $2,000 a day
for
me to be here. It was an enormous sum of money they were paying. And I had it all written on a blueprint, plus I'm sure there's some things I had there that they weren't aware of. But today, Kathy is 12 years sober.
Good for her.
Married. Yeah, she got out of an abusive relationship, and she is with another 12-stepper. And she has gave birth after she got out of recovery to the first child of a treated incest victim in our family.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
I mean, that is an amazing feat in itself, because this really is a family issue, and it takes a lot of strength to break out of that type of a family dynamic.
It is such a multi-generational problem. But when you get into recovery yourself, you can make a difference on other people that touch your lives. My other two daughters, while I was in recovery, seeing that I got away from my abuser, they got away from their abusers, and both of them are today in happy, healthy relationships. So you can really make a difference. And to contribute to the irony of this whole story, my son was an officer on the LAPD for 15 years. And I remember when he joined the academy and he said, Mom, I hope I can make a difference. All I could think of was, he's going to be out there, you know, capturing some of these bad guys,
mm-hmm.
some of these sex offenders. So my one son, who has never been sexually abused and still married after 20 years to the same woman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just thought it was so amazing.
Wow. Wow. You're all doing work in this area in some way.
That is definitely true. My youngest daughter, who had been raped at gunpoint, wanted to be a dancer. And after that happened, she decided, no, Mom, I want to be a nurse. Because while she was in the ER at the night that it happened to her, she had the experience of seeing that there were some of the nurses there that were not particularly compassionate. They
mm-hmm.
kind of treated her like she was a nobody there. And she said, you know what, I don't want to be that way. I want to do something different. So today she works in ER as an RN.
Oh, okay.
She's an excellent, excellent
nurse. I'm sure she is. So, Marjorie, take us back to the beginning when you were a child, and this whole cycle for you and your life began with the abuse.
When I was 13 years old, my father raped me, came into my bedroom. I was sleeping on the bottom bunk. My younger sister was in a 3-year-old sister was in a crib next to the bed, and my other sister slept on the top bunk. And I screamed and screamed and screamed for help. And my mother was a very heavy sleeper. By the time she actually got awake and came into my bedroom, my father was standing at the door with his robe, holding his robe closed, watching her. And I can remember just screaming and screaming at her, Mama, please help me, somebody was on top of me and they did something so bad, please help me. And I didn't know what it was. Believe it or not, at the age of 13, I knew nothing about
mm-hmm.
sex. I thought you bought babies at a hospital, and I wanted to be a nun.
A different time than now. Where?
Oh, it really was.
Yeah.
This was in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
And my mother just kept telling me I had a nightmare, and go back to sleep, you had a nightmare. And so after that, I never screamed for my mother. Eventually, she found out what my father was doing, and they got into a big argument about it. I woke up hearing them arguing, and then I heard my mother say, go get her out of bed, and my father came in and said, your mother wants to talk to you. And I remember going into the living room, and she started interrogating me about what's been happening in the bedroom, and I was afraid to tell her. I didn't know what it was anyway, and so I kept saying nothing, nothing, and she told my father, get a belt, and he began beating me. And I remember standing in that living room getting beat. I was terribly, terribly thin. I was like anorexic. We always looked like concentration camp victims. And we had a big framed copy of the Declaration of Independence. And I remember thinking if I read it, I could leave my body because the pain was so bad. And so I began reading when in the course of human events it becomes necessary, et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't leave my body. Eventually, I just started saying, it wasn't Daddy's fault. It's my fault, Mommy. It's my fault. It's all my fault. Don't blame Daddy.
Mm.
I did not want my family to break up, and I didn't know if they would. I didn't know what had happened. I mean, I was
so confusing for a surgeon.
Oh, extremely. All I knew was I had to stop beating, and I had to not let my mother be angry at my father, which it didn't matter. It destroyed our family. My mother, after that, laid in bed all the time and cried and carried on, and my father started working in another city and came home only on the weekends, and all of us children became just the most pathetic, sad people you can imagine in a house that was just torn apart. And that was in a little town in Nebraska called Petersburg. And then when I was 15, my family moved out to California, which I hated. I had always lived in small towns in the Midwest. I knew nothing about these big cities. And the abuse continued. It continued, and it just started damaging me so bad. And after I turned 18, I wanted to go to college. My parents said no, I had to go to work and help support the family. And no, I could not move out, that they would tell me if I could or not. And if I was 40 and they still wanted me to live there, I would always have to stay there. And so I said, if you don't stop being so strict with me, I'm going to wind up losing all the love and respect I have for you.
Well, so it was more mental and emotional abuse at that point?
Oh, no, it was mental and emotional, but I know my father continued the nighttime raids. I know he did, because he told me later when I was in my mid-30s, he told me what he did.
So you had kind of blocked that out?
Large parts of my teen years were, I had amnesia. I could remember bits and pieces, flickers, like looking at a photo screen or something, and you'd see a quick flash and it goes away. So anyway, my mom said, get the belt, and my dad gave me the worst beating I've ever had. I remember putting my hands in front of my face so that he couldn't hurt my face. And I remember blood flying, and it was, my brother came running out of the bedroom, and he hollered, he was a year older than me, and he hollered, Dad, stop it, you're killing her. And he tried to grab the belt away from my dad, and my dad turned around and slugged him, knocked him out cold, flying against the wall, and he continued beating me till I passed out. And when I came to, all I could think of was run, run, run. So a week later, I put everything in a pillow sack that I could find that was mine, and I ran away from home. And within a year, I had married my first abuser, an alcoholic, and we were married for 4 years, and then got a divorce and married my second abuser, another alcoholic, only this one was the one who sexually abused my children, which I didn't know about until I was halfway through recovery. He was also cheated on me, blatantly did it in front of me. And he would beat me up, and so that the abuse got exceedingly worse. Then I got a divorce, and I was single for about 12 years. During that time, I went from one alcoholic to another, and then I wound up eventually married to the worst abuser I had ever even known. And when I started going to therapy, I went to my doctor asking for antidepressants and sleeping pills because I was so suicidal. When I was in my early 20s, I had been hospitalized twice in a psychiatric ward for failed suicide attempt. So my doctor had always asked me if my father had ever molested me, and I always told him no. And he said, this time I don't believe you, and you've been kept alive on antidepressants and sleeping pills for 20 years. Well, this has to stop. So he sent me to Marcy Taylor, who is a child sexual abuse specialist, and I began my recovery, which wound up taking 5 years because I was with my abuser during that time, and the abuse got worse and worse and worse.
You stayed with your relationship, in your abusive relationship, while you were getting recovery.
Yes, I was. I stayed with him. I don't know if you know anything about people addiction, but being addicted to another person can be the worst kind of addiction there is.
Yeah.
Because if I tried to break up with him or tried to make him move out of my house because he was living in my house, I would literally vomit and get the dry heaves, and I'd have the shakes so bad, and I couldn't function. I had to have him back in my life. So I would always agree to anything that he wanted.
I've also heard, Marjorie, that is actually quite common, that women will go into therapy because if they were to end the relationship right at the beginning, they wouldn't have that inner strength yet at that time to really follow through with it. You know, they would eventually go back.
Yeah, you can't. It's just impossible. It's like being addicted to heroin or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I forgot one very important piece. During those years that I was single, I did meet one man who was my daughter's father-in-law. He had been divorced from her husband. And we started dating. He was the finest man I'd ever known. His only goal in life was to make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
We got engaged. We bought this beautiful home together. We had a grandson together. And then he started telling me, I wonder what happened to you when you were a child. He said, somebody as wonderful as you should not have been with all those abusers. So something must have happened. Well, I got very frightened. And I told him, nothing happened. Leave it alone.
Mm.
And the more I tried to get him to not go in that direction, the more determined he was to find out what happened to me. And so I tried to give him his ring back and break the engagement. And I said, I don't want to be with you anymore. I want you to go away. And he said, I will never leave you except through death. Well, within months, he was diagnosed with lung cancer.
Mm.
And so I spent several months trying to prepare him for death. And then after he died, that was when I wound up with my third abuser, the third marriage I was abused.
The worst one. Now, really, there were so many attempts. I know a little bit about this part of your story when you did meet someone that would have been a healthy partner for you, and there were so many attempts on your part to sabotage it and not, you know, when he wanted to delve deeper into your history, that you just wouldn't want to go there. And I think this is quite predictable for survivors of childhood sexual abuse, of sabotaging good relationships and then going for, you know, the abusive ones. So tell us a little bit about that, the predictability of that.
Well, one thing that I did when he wouldn't go away and wouldn't take his ring back is I wound up starting having an affair with a married man. Women who have been sexually abused as children, they have a lot of affairs with married men. And they don't know how to choose a healthy sexual relationship. And when I found out that Chuck had cancer, I ended that relationship and tried to take care of him. And then even at the last week before he died, I wound up in bed with another married man.
Mm.
I mean, I was addicted to sex. I had been addicted to sex since I was 18 years old. I mean, I couldn't get enough of it.
Mm.
And then Chuck died, and after he died, my shame was so great that I had done this to the man who was the finest man I'd ever known. But I kept journals. All these years I'd been writing since I was 13. I'd been writing poetry and short stories and journals. And my third abuser, who I wound up marrying, he got a hold of my journals, and he found out everything I had ever done.
Wow.
Affairs with married men, cheating on guys I was with. I mean, all of my shame, especially that last weekend before Chuck died, my shame was exposed to him, and he used it as a weapon to hit me with, to get me to do whatever he wanted me to do, whether it was I wasn't allowed to laugh, I was only allowed to wear certain clothes, I was not allowed to be in the front yard. The controls that he put in my, I lived like a prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And my beautiful home became so badly damaged from hiding behind the bathroom doors to get away from it, because he was a worse sex addict than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And he would rape me several times a day, and I did not know that I had the right to say no, even to my husband. And then when I wouldn't do what he told me, that he would start taunting me over and over with how I was a cheat, how I was no good, how I had cheated. Oh, if I was dying, you would be cheating on me with a married man, wouldn't you? I mean, he just battered me with that so bad, and I would do whatever he told me, including one time forced me to make sex videotapes where I lost my mind. I literally, all I could remember was I was laying underneath a chair crying for my mother.
Mm.
And he was coldly putting the film camera away, and
wow.
It was, yeah, the it's so predictable what is going to happen to you if you stay in that relationship.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books, as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I am talking today with Marjorie McKinnon. Her new book, Repair Your Life, A Program for Recovery from Incest and Childhood Sexual Abuse, is out now on Loving Healing Press. And you can find out more about Marjorie and her book through the website, thelamplighters.org. So would you say that the dominating emotion for someone that has been abused as a child is shame, and that's the emotion that a predator will prey on?
That is the largest part of it, is the shame. And you know, sex offenders look for the most obedient child in the schoolyard. Mm. So a woman who is obedient, pliable, who they can get to do anything they want to, is what they're looking for. And the shame is this core issue. I thought that I was the worst person in the world. I remember one time I thought I was ugly everywhere. Ugly soul, ugly face, ugly body, ugly everything. And it always amazed me, why do guys want to date me? Oh, it must be because I'm a sex addict, you know, so I would just shove that out of my mind. But one time I was in a department store and I saw a woman there who I thought was so attractive. And I thought, oh, God, why can't I look like her? Why do I have to look like me? And I got in an instant bad mood and I continued my shopping. Periodically I would look over at the woman and I would have the same thoughts. Well, as I was leaving the store, I was looking at her and I raised my hand to scratch my head. And she scratched her head, and I put my hand on my nose, and she put her hand on my nose. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm looking in a mirror. Even then, I walked over to, it was one of those floor-to-ceiling mirrors in a department store. I walked over there, and I had to keep touching the mirror because I couldn't believe that was me.
Wow.
It still did not have the power to make me believe that there was anything about me that was beautiful, because I was still in the midst of all of this abuse.
Mm.
So you can't really see. You're so blind when you're abused. You're so blind. You have no clue that there's any part of you that can be beautiful. You're covered with shame.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how that can distort every aspect of your thinking and your perspective on life. That shame.
Yeah, that's really true.
Yeah,
really true.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about codependency, because I think when you first got into recovery, codependency was one of the big issues that you were tackling. So for listeners today, what is it? And then explain its intimate connection with victims of early sexual abuse.
Well, one of the things about codependency is that they have very, very little self-esteem. And they also are overachievers. I mean, they can never quite do enough to be good enough. They're always thinking that they have to take care of other people, that they are not important themselves. They don't watch out for themselves. They don't know how to protect themselves. It's such a place of having no feeling of having any worth at all. I mean, it's just, that's what codependency is. It's this total, total low self-esteem. And as a result, you wind up pulling in a lot of people who can dominate you. I mean, you, a healthy person raised in a healthy environment, not sexually abused, will wind up, you know, if they meet somebody who's a potential abuser, they will look at them and go, I don't want to date you. Who'd date somebody like you? It's obvious to me you're blah, blah, blah. So they'll walk away. But a codependent person, and especially if you've been sexually abused, you wind up with all these codependent traits. Plus, you have other issues that codependency, you know, doesn't address, like sexual issues and that sort of thing, but they're very, very strongly tied to each other. It's like you get on a path. You one morning you wake up and you're wonderful and life is good and you have your mom and your daddy and your family, and then your daddy enters the bedroom or Uncle Joe grabs you in a closet or something happens where you're sexually abused, and all of a sudden you start down a path that is so dark and so filled with despair, and you can't turn.
Mm-hmm. Now, with codependency, though, isn't it a bit of an elusive type of thing? Because from what I understand, there are some people that, you know, may not outwardly project that low self-esteem. You may not look at them and their situation and really realize they're codependent. And so it's kind of, I don't know, for someone listening that may not quite resonate with that really low, obvious form of codependency, you know, what could they know about themselves that would suggest that they do have a codependency issue? Maybe not quite to that extreme.
Oh, well, that's a very good question. The first codependency meeting I went with a friend of mine, and when we came out, all I could think of was, oh, my God, that's me. And my friend said, well, being a codependent is noble. Why are they talking about it as if it's something that you shouldn't be? Well, I think it's really noble to be there for somebody that you love and always put other people first and not yourself and so on and so forth. And so we came out with different views on the whole thing. And codependency is just so weakens the spirit. And you need to look at your life. Even if you knew what a codependency, you know, what the codependency traits were, even if you could see that you had some of them, you might think, oh, well, so what? That's no big deal. You look at your life. Are you happy in your life? Are you with a healthy partner, one that treats you with respect and care? Do you make healthy choices in your life on everything that you do? Are you filled with despair? Are you filled with joy? You know, this, it's easy to tell when you have had a problem in your childhood. You may like to cover it up in some way or another, as I did. I always told everybody I had a happy childhood. I told them how wonderful my father was, et cetera, et cetera. I gave them that spiel for a long time because I put into a closet in my mind all the bad stuff because I didn't want to look at it. And it's, you see what happens as a result. When you look at your life, somebody who comes to me and says, well, you know, my life is okay. I mean, I know my husband goes out and drinks every night, but you know, don't all husbands? And I hate my job, but you know, I don't think I'm good enough to do anything else. Just, you start looking at these things, and that's not what a healthy person says about their life. And so there's a reason that you come up with those kind of traits. It starts somewhere. And that's why it's important to go back and look at your childhood and identify the source. I know there's a lot of therapists, and this saddens me so much, but there's a lot of therapists who say, I don't want you to go back and look at your childhood at all. Let's just start from today and move forward and handle your problems that way. And I've had phone calls and emails from women who say this is the way their therapist is trying to help them, and they're not getting any help from it. And they don't agree with not going back. But I know that is the way some therapists are handling it. And I have no degrees. I have no initials after my name. But I do know one thing, and that's when you have been wounded, if you do not treat that wound, it will get infected. Mm. And the infection will spread throughout your body. You need to go in there and lance the wound, put ointment on the wound, and someday it will be nothing but a small scar that you'll remember with objectivity, but it won't have the power to hurt you anymore. But if you don't do that, it'll show up somewhere. It may be when you're 50 and you all of a sudden find that you're suicidal and you realize some things about your life you've been lying about.
So is this then the R, the recognition in your repair program?
Yes, you're right. That's R. Recognition is the first stage. If you do not admit and see, understand, identify what happened, you can't go any further. That's what I call part of, in my mind, when I was developing this program, it was what I called feel, real, heal. You had to real feel heal is what it was. You had to make real what happened to you. You could no longer just say, well, I had nightmares, you know. Mm. And then you have to feel everything that comes with the lancing of the wound. It's not easy. And then you can heal. I mean, I've had people that are working the repair program or reading the book, and they'll get to a certain page, the part that tells them the identification about all the traits of a child of sexual abuse, and they get so depressed and so upset they can't go any further. They put it away. And I tell them, you have to go through this in order to get to the other side. Mm. You can't just say, oh, I don't want to look at my childhood. I mean, this is what is, you know.
You have to look at it.
Better the devil I know than the devil I don't. I mean, that's a great analogy of what a lot of people wind up telling themselves. But you have got to get well if you were abused as a child. If you do not, somewhere in your life, somewhere down the road, not only will it do you great damage, but you are already passing on traits to your children that will cause them to be potential victims for either domestic violence situations or child sexual abuse or even sexual assault as an adult.
Good point. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's kind of break down your repair program, and we'll briefly touch on each aspect. You have six points. Repair is an acronym, so we started with R for recognition. Let's do E.
Okay, E is entry, where you enter a program of commitment to change your life for the better. And it basically, I explain, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to start recovery. How to choose the right therapist, how to choose a healthy support group, whether or not to go to 12 steps, how you want to go about. It's like laying out a map for yourself. You're laying out your own program of what you're going to do. And entry helps you through all of those decisions.
Mm. And would you suggest then that people do see a therapist or do go to support groups? I mean, I can't imagine that someone could heal from these kinds of issues all by themselves.
Well, if you can find a therapist who has childhood sexual abuse as one of her specialties, she's already healed a lot of people that have that problem, or especially a therapist who has been through that herself as a child. To get a therapist that doesn't deal with those kind of issues and has never had that kind of issue would not be a good idea. I strongly recommend 12-step programs. I went through codependency, and I work and into Survivors Anonymous. I was working two of them at the same time, and I went from step one all the way to 12-step just the way I should. It was tremendous, tremendous help. So I would recommend at the very least going into a 12-step program while you're working repair. The right therapist would be a good idea also.
Okay. So P?
That's where you have, I teach you tools and techniques that take you through this trip.
And P for process.
Yeah, process. That's what process is. I mean, to me, it's like you're crossing a bridge. I call it the bridge of recovery, which is a visual tool. And I give you tools to use as you start going across this bridge. They're exercises and they're techniques. And you can do them at your own pace, and that's the meat of the program right there in the process.
Okay, so A.
And that's awareness, which is the coming together of reality as you start gathering the pieces of the broken puzzle your life became, and you start assembling all of them to look at a complete picture of your life. And here you discover properties of awareness, God-given gifts, promises at birth that were ripped away from you when you were molested.
I imagine that's when you start feeling better about the whole recovery process
in the
awareness phase. Mm-hmm.
You really do. You start seeing that you were just a pawn on a chessboard, and that you were set up. This had nothing to do with you. This wasn't because you were a bad person, which is what we all think we are. Once you start putting the guilt on the person who really is responsible for it, and you start moving away from that shame yourself, things start coming together in this awareness stage. It's a really, really wonderful place to be. By the time you're there, you can start seeing the light on the other side of the bridge. And then insight, you really see the complete picture, and you start to return to who you were before you were violated. That's what the eye, the insight is. It's like the final part of awareness. And then rhythm is where, that's the last R, that's where you return to that which you were before you were molested. I mean, when you were born, you already had your own traits there, whether it's DNA or hereditary or whatever you want. And they were all ripped away from you when you were abused. And so at this time in the program, you go back to who you really were.
Mm.
You rejoin yourself as you were supposed to be, as it was promised at birth.
So were you basically at that point really detaching from that whole victimhood, victim consciousness that you've probably been going through for most of your life, and you're finding out what's beyond that, who you really truly are?
Yes, yes. That's, you know, and these techniques are really the ones that, you know, one of the things that I did was I found a shirt that said, "What part of no don't you understand?" And I was terrified to wear that shirt, but I bought it and I wore it around
wow.
my husband.
That's a statement. What for your husband?
Oh, my gosh. He would look at that shirt and he would go take it off.
I bet he would.
I say, "Can't you read it?" It empowered me. I mean, yeah. Different. That's just one thing that I did, but there's several things that I did during that time that not only empowered me, but I was changing, and I didn't even realize I was changing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was, towards the end of my recovery, I kept thinking, I'm not there yet. He's still in my house. What am I going to do? So what I did was I went back to the house where I had been sexually abused. I knocked on the door. A woman named Margie lived there, if you can believe that.
Oh, gosh.
And I asked her if I could look at the house that I used to live there, and she took me, and I went into that back bedroom, and, oh, my gosh, everything came back to me as I walked into that room. I got so dizzy, and my knees were knocking, and I could remember it all. But it made me so strong. I mean, I came out of there, and I cried and cried and cried, and I thought, I'm ready. I went back home. I had one final thing I had to do, but then I got him out of the house and got the divorce, went through 6 months of post-recovery, and been doing nothing but good stuff ever since.
For the last 5 years?
Yeah.
Well,
yes.
Congratulations. What a story, Marjorie. I mean, really, you, I'm sure, have been an inspiration to many, many people. And I know with Lamplighters, I mean, the word is really getting out, and people are contacting you that are trying to get out of their own abusive situations. They're wanting help.
Yes, I can't tell you how many stories I have heard, and no matter how many I hear, I still can't get over it. I mean, mm-hmm. It's like every time I hear one more story, it just saddens me to the core.
Yeah.
And because we all have the same stories, even though we all have different stories.
Different, like, well said. So what, for someone listening to the today that may just be really in the midst of it all, what are some of the positive results that recovery will bring to someone utilizing this repair program? You know, you're saying that, you know, before recovery, pain, shame, addictions, eating disorders, suicidal tendencies, all of this, very low self-esteem, all of that. So what are the positives that you can put out there for people for what recovery will really mean for them?
Well, one of the main things is they will become who they were intended to be. They will become a new person, somebody who has walked away from all that garbage that's been on them. They will have stronger self-esteem. They will feel empowered. If they are with an abuser, they will have the courage and the strength to end the relationship, and they will have the tools to make decisions in their life as they go forward that will give them only healthy choices. They will no longer have low self-esteem. They will now feel that they have worth. And they can pick choices in their life with their job, whether they get married or not, whether they have children or not, whether they want to travel. They can make all those choices from a place of power instead of a place of low self-esteem. I can't tell you how it can change your life.
I imagine that just the joy and the happiness that really come from within is is also profound for you.
Oh, it is. And I can't even believe that I used to try to kill myself.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
sometimes I say to God, please disregard previous instructions.
Yeah.
But there was one time when I was married to my abuser, my last abuser, and I was also going through a sexual harassment thing at work, so I was getting it in both areas.
Wow.
And I went out to lunch one day, and my despair was so great as I came to the street to cross the street to go back to work. It was a very busy street, and I saw a big semi-truck coming down the road. And I thought, now I can do it, and nobody will interfere and stop it, and I will do it for sure. So as soon as the truck got right up next to me, I threw myself in its path. Somebody grabbed me back from my shirt and pulled me away. And I can still remember the whir of the wind as it went from the truck across, across my face as I was just seconds away from that truck. And I was so angry that somebody would one more time interfere with my right to kill myself. And I turned around getting ready to give him a bad edge of my tongue, and there wasn't anybody there.
Mm.
And that is the true story.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, I mean, after that.
You were meant to be here. You were meant to be doing this work.
Oh, I know. I just kept thinking to myself, maybe I'm not supposed to die.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a turning point in my recovery. It really was.
I imagine. Wow. Marjorie, what a story. What amazing work you're doing. This is a fantastic book. Wish you so much success with it. And I just want to thank you again for coming on the program today. This has been great talking with you.
Oh, well, I want to thank you, because anything I can do to get more lamplighters and more people work in the repair program, that's what my goal is. And so you're helping me with this, and I appreciate it no end.
Yeah, you bet. So let's mention your website once again, thelamplighters.org. And I'm just going to let you have the last 30 seconds here to share your final thoughts with your listeners today.
Well, for anybody out there that feels in any way that there was some kind of child abuse issue in their past and that their life today is not filled with joy, not with a healthy partner, please, please type in thelamplighters.org and get some information about what you can do to make yourself better. And think about buying the book Repair and beginning to work that program, because it will take you from being not happy and living in despair to being the happiest person you know. That's what I am today, is the happiest person I know. When I got out of recovery, I had a sign over my desk that said, if I'd known life was going to turn out this good, I would have started it sooner.
Mm.
And that, too, can be your sign when you get out of recovery, but you've got to do something now before it's too late. Please email me with any questions that you have, or if I can help in any way, please contact me.
Wonderful, Marjorie. Thank you so much. You know, our time went by so quick here. We didn't even get to talk about the children's version of the book, but, you know, I think we will be talking again, so I hope to have you back, and we'll talk all about that.
Okay, that'd be great.
Great, Marjorie. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, listeners, I've been talking with Marjorie McKinnon. Her book, Repair Your Life, is out now on Loving Healing Press. You can order it through online and local booksellers as well. I believe through her website. You can give it a check, www.thelamplighters.org. So I hope you've enjoyed this interview. It's just been a wealth of information, and if anything has resonated here with you, please do contact Marjorie. Her email is on her website. So thank you so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live today. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.